Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. And specifically, we're going to talk about brooking the truth, or brooking the lie, depending on whichever one you want to do. I listened to a kind of symposium, or I guess it was a little bit of a conference that was put together by the Brookings Institute, a forum of several of their top people at the Brookings Institute, and they were talking about the effect of robotics on employment in the country for the next 20, 30 years, because they see robotics is replacing large numbers of people. There's constantly factories that are downsizing as far as number of employees, but because they can increase production through robotics. And they were wondering how this was going to affect the job market and society in general. And that sounds like kind of a benevolent conversation, and you're getting these people from one of the bigger think tanks in Washington, D.C., so you think, well, they're going to give you some information that might be of value. These are the smart guys. I never heard such claptrap in all my life. Actually, I have. I've been around for a long time. But so I listened to it, and now I have it up on a webpage at His Holy Church. Actually, it's at preparingyou.com, which is another one of our alternate sites. And it's not quite finished yet, but I was going to save this particular page as with the title of Brooking. Because brooking is a word that means to allow, allowing or putting up with something, some sort of scheme, some sort of idea, some sort of condition, and you allow and put up with it. And of course, we have to allow and put up with idiots. Unfortunately, we can't just exterminate them, so we have to accept them as. But we don't have to accept what they're doing, or at least we shouldn't have to accept what they're doing. We don't have to do what fools do. But yet, you're in society, if enough people start doing something foolish, you kind of get dragged along with it. And accepting a lie as the truth is brooking the lie, as opposed to the truth. You may even allow the truth to exist, but you don't have anything to do with it. But you allow the lie to exist. Now, we allow the lie to exist, but we expose it as a lie. And what is a lie? Now, that's another definition I put on the page. I was going to, like I say, save this page under the name of Brooking, and I discovered that I already had a page by that name that I had never quite finished. So I went through that this morning for about 3 hours before the first radio programs, and kind of finish that. So now I have to leave this, but I'm putting them all together along with a number of other pages that cover some of these same issues from different points of view. Expanded the page on Folkemet, which is a Scandinavian Swedish word for your home. You're kind of the home society. It kind of stands for the way in which the Swedish have put together their society. And a lot of people think that Sweden is a successful socialist state, and they hold it up as kind of a model socialist state. In reality, Sweden is absolutely falling apart. But what has made Sweden the success that it was not socialism. It was the centuries and centuries of isolated non-socialism in the society. Their work ethic, their the wisdom that comes with seasons, hard winters, remote part of the world, and the intelligence not to get in unnecessary wars. Although they've kind of ticked off Norway a couple of times by letting, like, the Germans go through. And now they're letting some of the immigrants go through. I mean, Norway had a tremendous crime problem that had increased when they allowed a lot of immigrants into their country a number of years ago. And so they deported about I don't remember the exact number, 600 or 800 people that had been committing crimes, and they just simply deported those people. And crime went down like hundreds of percentage points. I mean, several hundred. I actually think it was maybe even, even less than that. Just a couple hundred people were deported, and the crime rate went down about 800%, which was phenomenal. But they deported them back to their original countries. But Sweden is just letting them back in to Sweden, and then they just walk across the Norwegian-Swedish border. And Norway didn't quite like that. But Sweden is so afraid of being considered racist that they have bent over backwards to let these people in. But now the crime rate is skyrocketing. Rape is skyrocketing in the country. And it's the immigrants, males, raping white, blue-eyed, blonde Norwegian women. And I mean, it's really a serious, serious problem. There's already areas in Norway, not Norway so much, but Sweden, in some of the towns where it's a no-go zone. That's insane. You're not inviting in immigrants. You're being invaded. Immigrants come in and try to work themselves into the existing culture and respecting it. These people are not all doing that. Now, there are some that are, and there's some that are not, and they need to develop policies that just simply say that if you get out of line, you're out of here. But anyway, so I added more to that page on Folkemmet, which is a little bit of a look at how and why Sweden is successful. I'm linking those pages with other pages on Norway and Denmark. I just noticed I don't have the link yet on this one page, but I'll add it probably at the break. But it's giving you an insight into good governments and bad governments and where good governments sometimes go bad. Now, people are the government, unless, of course, they give the power, their inalienable rights, to somebody else to be the government for them. Now that institution they create becomes the government, and they often become subject to it. Because if you give the responsibility of doing certain things that are natural to mankind to somebody else, you lose the right that goes along with that responsibility. See, every responsibility gives you a certain right. You have a right to do this because you have a responsibility to do this. You have a right to accumulate food and firewood for the winter, because if you don't, you'll starve. And you have a right to do that, especially if you do not hoard but actually share with other people. That you're doing it to help take care of other people, so you have a natural right. But if you start doing things outside of the law of nature and start giving over your responsibilities to other people, you can suffer serious setbacks because of that, as far as access to your rights. So if you want your rights back, you have to take back your responsibilities. So anyway, we talked about this brooking, and I, again, the definition of a lie. I didn't quite get to the whole one. Obviously, it's an intentional falsehood. Somebody's actually lying to you. They know the truth, and they're just telling you a lie on purpose. That's a lie. But that's not the only thing that's a lie. The word lie can also reference a situation that is involving deception, where somebody's just deceiving you a little bit because they may not have told you a lie, but they didn't quite tell you the whole truth. So that could be a lie too, by omission. But that's still not all the definition of a lie. It also can be something that somebody says that's founded on a mistake or a mistaken impression. In other words, if somebody tells you a lie, but they believe it's the truth, it's still a lie. They told you a lie. They were in error to begin with, and they didn't mean to lie to you, but they did lie to you. Yeah, so the lie that is told to you doesn't have to be intentional. And those are the one of the most dangerous kinds of lies, because the person who's telling you actually believes what they're telling you is true. So anyway, the question was asked in this Brookings forum that they put together, and we have a link to it. It's an hour and 28 minutes long, but you can watch the video on our webpage. And the webpage is robotics. It's not quite finished, but if you're listening live, you can go and read it and see some of the footnotes. And we started putting in links to other articles that, so you can kind of put all this stuff into perspective. Anyway, the question they asked was, how will robotics affect the availability of employment and social benefits within society? And this question is not what changes will be caused with the increase of robots, but what happens when we become robots. That's really what the question should be, because that's what these guys have become who are discussing this. They're not really thinking for themselves. They've accepted actually a number of deceptions and mistaken impressions of the past. And now they are propagating a lie based on their misconceptions. They're real smart guys in about a lot of things, but you know, you can always find scholars who disagree. So being a real smart guy doesn't mean necessarily that you've got the right answer. And then somebody comes along, and this is why you have debates, and they say, hey, look, you're thinking that this is the case. No, it's not. It's not the case. So I also included the definition of a robot. A robot is a machine capable of carrying out complex series of actions automatically, especially one programmable. Well, people are programmable. We always hear about that. Manchurian candidates, brainwashing, cult leaders. You know, one of the things I always thought was interesting, people are always saying that we're a cult or something, and really we're the worst. You know, we have a whole page on cults, shows you all the criteria to identify a cult, and almost nothing even comes close to matching what we do. But the word cult was originally applied to the imperial cult of Rome. And what was that? That was their social welfare system made them a cult. Because once you signed up, you couldn't leave. You actually legally couldn't leave. You'd have to go to someplace like Ireland or someplace where Rome didn't exist to get out of the system. Because wherever you went in the Pax Romana, you were expected to pay in because you were a member. Now, you could be a member of the Roman Imperial cult, or you could be a member of the Pharisaical Herodian cult. And if you were a member, you couldn't leave those systems. Well, at the time of Christ, the Pharisees allowed you to leave. As a matter of fact, they actually kicked you out of the Pharisaical cult of Corban that they had, that had been set up by Herod. And they allowed you to leave if you got the baptism of Jesus Christ. If you got that baptism, you were cast out. And it meant you wouldn't get any more benefits from the cult. They wouldn't help you out anymore. You would have no more social welfare delivered to you through the synagogues or through the temple. You would be on your own. You'd be out of the Herodian cult in Judea. And that actually extended to Syria. He had temples in Syria. And it actually even extended to Rome itself. Because Herod spent a lot of time in Rome, especially in his earlier life. He was a favorite of people like Tiberius when Tiberius was a young man. But anyway, another drama, but we'll talk about that some other time. The point is, that's once you're in that membership and that social welfare system, you automatically have to do certain things. You don't get a choice. Just like a robot doesn't get a choice. He has to do certain things. So that's when we start become when we start giving up our right to choose, we became robotic in nature. We don't have a choice. We have to do something. We become part of, and we even use the term machine, the social machine. And then we even talk about social engineering, setting up certain things where things in society have to do a certain way. And that takes away the human element of choice. You don't get to choose anymore about this, this, and this because you're a member. You may mimic certain human movements as if you're making decisions, but actually you're automatically required to follow a certain set of procedures and behaviors. And they have synonyms for this word robot, such as automaton, android, but also golem. And we've talked before about the golem. The golem is like a corporation, a person. It even says in the definition, more used to refer to a person who behaves in a mechanical or unemotional manner. They mechanically do things without emotion. They don't really care. And this is really going to play into it, because you don't think you're an unemotional person, but you actually, I will show you that in certain areas you are. Now, the last thing I found interesting in following this word robot is that it actually comes from a Czechoslovakian word, which I thought was interesting. Usually you expect it to be like a Greek word or something, but it actually comes from a Czechoslovakian word, which is also where the golem was originally something that came out of Jewish folklore in Czechoslovakia. But the Czech word is robota. And you know what it actually means? It means forced labor. So if you're forced to labor, you've become, at least to that degree, robotic. If you don't have the right to choose over certain mechanical elements of society, the mechanism of society, you become robotic. Okay, am I still on? We just had power outage here. I don't know if I was completely disconnected. Oh, I'm still here. Okay. Oh, everything went black for a while. But we had power come back on. So anyway, everything, all the computers still seem to be working. Anyway, this idea of, you don't think of yourself as a robot, but if you're forced to labor, if you're forced to provide certain of the energy and functions of society mechanically, you don't have a choice about it, then what are you becoming robotic? Now, societies for thousands of years, if you go back, the general history of society, if you go back and study how societies came together, organized themselves, you know, we have this tendency because we come out of school. Actually, we don't come out of school studying much history anymore. But say if you're in your 40s, 50s, you probably studied some history when you went to school. Now they call it social studies. But in history, you have this tendency to think that government has to do with, you know, king, prime minister, president, emperor, you know, these different offices, and they're running the government. But most government throughout history has been voluntary systems where the people just came together and made agreements, even not just villages, but, you know, networks of villages. Abraham, his altars were a part of a system or government of, and he was able to muster an entire army overnight to defeat these kings that were coming through and taking city state after city state and had taken Sodom and taken his nephew captive. Well, they were able to muster an army overnight. What government did they have? How did they do it? Well, it was an all-voluntary government. But there were certain mechanisms to maintain that voluntary government, and that's what these altars were. They were part of that mechanism. You would choose someone who is your friend, who is a man of service, and he would become a stone of the altar, and he would gather together with other men like himself that were chosen by other people, and he would link villages together. Small groups of people would be linked by these men. If there was fire or flood over here or a famine or a drought, these people over here in the other area that didn't suffer that drought, famine, flood, fire, would be able to send relief to help people out. Otherwise, they would just starve, you know, and everybody would be, in their whole communities would be in a lot of trouble. And somebody could come in and take over their houses and kill them because they didn't have the strength to resist. So for mutual defense and for protection against cataclysms, they gathered together in voluntary networks. No taxes, but there was a flow of contributions. to take care of the needy of their society, whether it was individuals within their village or groups in villages somewhere else who were falling on hard times. And that was government. But it wasn't authoritarian government. It wasn't top-down government. It was bottom-up. It was grassroots. Most governments throughout the history of mankind operated that way. And I'm not just saying this. I can show you books. Enterprise of Law by a fellow named Benson, who's a scholar, goes through and shows you example after example that this is the most common form of government. That giving and receiving of aid in local communities and in a broader network of communities is part of the mechanisms of society. That mechanism of society often incurs a certain amount of emotional connections. They would have feasts and families would marry and intermarry. And so you might have grandsons. I have two grandsons down in Nevada. And they live in a little tiny town way down in Nevada. And I don't see them very often, but they're getting bigger and bigger. I hear about them on Facebook when they get into trouble. But so we're connected to them. And actually, that we have cousins that are down there. We have cousins in North Dakota. We have cousins in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so we have connections back to those places. And those are a long ways away. But if somebody was in trouble back there, you know, we could get, and we gave the example when we thought a nuclear power plant was going to maybe be flooded and go Fukushima in the Midwest. People in the network invited all the people in that congregation near that nuclear power plant that if they suddenly had to evacuate, they could come here or there. And it was all, and it was just voluntary, it just came out. Nobody was asking for it, but the volunteerism came out. Well, that used to be the only way to get social welfare. And that was the mechanics of society. That's what bound societies together. That's what protected societies, is this mutual connection that they had. It wasn't robotic. It involved emotions of caring. Today, to take care of the needy in a distant area, you just send a check-in. And most of the time, you have to send the check-in, you know, like on April 15th, everybody sends a check-in. Most people are sending in checks every month to the mechanisms of society, which compel that offering of the people. And there's no emotion in there involved, except for maybe you might be a little disgruntled because you think they're taking too much and not doing a good job. But you have to give it anyway because it's automatic. It's mechanical. You're forced to labor to feed that system. So see, you already are becoming robotic. But, and we probably won't get to all of it in this show, but this article that we're putting together is going into a very in-depth study about what these people in this think tank were actually saying and what they were concluding. You see, the Brookings Institute, it's an American think tank, kind of, based back on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. This Brookings describes itself as an independent, nonpartisan think tank. But if you actually look into it, the Brookings Board of Trustees includes mainly prominent Democrats. As a matter of fact, if you look at the donations of employees, say from 2003 to 2010, 97.6% of the Brookings employees, including the people in this, you know, symposium or forum, went to Democrats. So it's not bipartisan. It has a very decided. Not only that, but the Brookings Institute also receives donations because it's a nonprofit, you know, think tank kind of thing. Well, it received $14.8 million from the foreign country of Qatari. And that just happens to be one of the larger foreign countries that donated to it. All kinds of people donate to it. And when you donate to it, pretty much you're guaranteeing that they will never say anything bad about you, and chances are they will publish several articles that are put you in a very favorable light, because it's big bucks. It's like Pharmacia. You know, it's simply the way they operate. So, but it's still a think tank, and it's highly respected, and it actually comes up, you know, if you get that many smart people together, you're bound to come up with some good ideas now and then. Somebody posted it to one of our groups because they thought that these guys were really good. And there are some vague references to things that are kind of good amongst them, but there's some very insidious lying going on. And lying maybe in the sense of simply they are deceived and have some misconceptions. And so we've given the benefit of the doubt, but lying nonetheless, based on the definition. So anyway, we'll take a look at that, but we need to take a break right now. And we'll talk about this, brooking the truth and brooking the lie, when we come back after a brief break. Okay, well, welcome back. We're talking about this idea of, are we becoming mechanical automatons? Are we becoming robots? And where do we get to the point where we're actually accepting these ideas as if that's a good thing? And that's actually what's happening, because these very bright and intelligent guys are suggesting all kinds of things that simply are not true. And so I asked the question, are we becoming robots by removing the elements of individual compassion and love for one another as an element and factor in our daily choices within the natural functions of society? Because before there's any kind of a society, man is in what we call a natural state. And he comes together by numerous different processes and schemes and theories and customs. And how he comes together will begin to alter the nature of his society, even alter the nature of his own thinking. And so if we're in search of truth, when we look at what we're doing, we can start to see what the ramifications and effects are. And sometimes we will misidentify them, like I was talking about with Sweden, where they think that Sweden is a successful country and all this stuff based on the fact that it's a socialist state, when it's actually, Sweden would be way, way better off if it wasn't a socialist state. But it's been riding for years on its cultural laurels, if you will. And still somewhat, there are other factors besides the socialism part. And we have a video up there now on that page that begins to explain, at least statistically, that the success of Sweden is not because it's a socialist state. It's in spite of the fact that it's a socialist state. So anyway, in the video that we have on our robot page is this video of the Brookings Institute gathered these sharp, successful individuals who suggested that the future, in the future, over a quarter of the males will be unemployed. That's 25% of the male population will be unemployed. And one-third of the jobs that are available will be in healthcare. That's just crazy. One-third. That means only two-thirds of the jobs that are available are not in healthcare. And of course, that's their projection, and they imagine that to be the case, But that's imagining that there isn't a total economic collapse and World War III and all kinds of other things that might come along instead. I was shocked at what was seemingly intelligent men coming to some of the foolish conclusions that they were coming to. And so I listened closely and tried to figure out what exactly, where exactly did they go wrong? Now, I'm sure if you ask these guys what they were up to, they would say, "We only wish to raise the quality of life for all species." And of course, you see that all the time. I actually heard an interesting note, but that I will talk about the fact that I use the word species here. And I'm really just quoting the Borg in science fiction programs, because it's really, that's the thinking that you're facing. And you have to remember that when people write science fiction, they often base it on things that are happening in real life, real people, real characteristics, and real principles. But they just simply put it in a science fiction setting. But I just heard, you know, the average price for, if you sell sheep, if you raise sheep to market and you take them to market right now, they're running around $1.50 a pound is what you sell. And you sell them on the hoof. And then they go and they eventually get butchered and people buy them in the store. And we don't buy any meat in the store. We produce all the meat that we eat. But I heard of another group of people that are actually getting like $2.40. You know, that's a huge increase per pound. And I thought, well, why are they getting so much? Well, they add extra criteria. And some of their criteria is that the animals can never be penned up for more than 8 hours. And you have to have all these special conditions because you have to treat them so that the quality of their life is better. Well, of course, I was out for hours watching sheep today, irrigating pastures so that there would be lots of green grass for them to eat. My wife was out there. Another minister took her place so that she could come in because it's howling wind outside. And so we take care of them all the time. But, you know, they lock themselves up for more than 8 hours. It would be cruel out here if you didn't lock them up for 8 hours. Evidently, somebody who probably lives in the cities thinks that that's somehow cruel. Tonight, when the sun goes down, all those sheep will walk off the desert. They will walk back up to the place where we have a trailer. And they will go in the gate on their own. And nobody has to tell them to do it. They will just do it. And they will do it because if they stay out overnight, coyotes and bobcats and mountain lions will eat them. During the day, they're safe. But at night, the coyotes will come right up, rip their throats out, rip their guts open, and eat them one bite at a time. So it'd be cruel not to lock them up. We're not locking them up. We're locking the danger away from them. But I guess they wouldn't qualify as humane treatment because somebody made these rules up. And you're supposed to follow those rules, or you're not being nice to your sheep. Well, of course, that's insane. That you have to look at every situation as it really is, and all the details, and you realize that, no, you have to do it this way in order that people have a more quality life. Anyway, even though these guys who are in this think tank seem to be capitalists. They're all rich. Some of them are millionaires, make lots and lots of money, very successful, workaholics. And so they seem, you say, well, they're capitalists. But no, they're actually socialists. And so I ask the question, what's the difference between capitalism and socialism? I hear all the time, and it's always worth pointing out, because people are always saying capitalism is bad and socialism is good. You hear young people espousing this, especially people who've gone to college, which is one of the places where you are brainwashed. And so let's put the definition out and actually look at the definition. Well, socialism is defined, and I'm not. I told this to somebody the other day and says, well, that's your definition. No, it's the definition of the word. It says, well, that's what some people think. That's what the dictionary says. I mean, are you making up a different language? You have to go by something. And I'm the first one to admit the dictionaries will change the definition. If you want to look at the definition of religion 200 years ago, it's a completely different word. Anytime you read a book 200 years ago where you see the word religion, that person who wrote that word down probably didn't mean anything like what you think when you read the religion or write the word religion down today. Because the definitions 200 years ago and the definitions today are completely at different ends of the spectrum. They have almost nothing in common. Vaguely they do. But they're certainly not talking about the same thing. And if you want to know, you go look up the word. I'm not going to go into that. We're looking at socialism. Socialism, political and economic theory of social organization. So right there, it's political, it's economic, it's a theory concerned with social organization that advocates that the means of production, distribution, and exchange, that's of everything in society that can be distributed, exchanged, or produced, should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole, the community as a whole, not individually. See, so if you produce something, you want to sell it, if you want to distribute it, if you want to give it away, they're saying you don't have the right to decide that. That will be regulated, how you do that. It'll be controlled by the community as a whole. In other words, the community will probably elect somebody and they will rule over what you produce, how you distribute it, how you exchange it. They will control that. That's socialism. Capitalism. So is capitalism like the opposite of that? Well, capitalism is defined as an economic system. It's not an economic theory. It's an economic system. So right now we're comparing theory and system. We're not comparing apples and oranges at all. We're comparing maybe fruits and nuts. Not even that. So capitalism is an economic system in which the investment in and ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange, same things, of wealth, of things that you produce, is made and maintained chiefly by private individuals. So only different, all capitalism is the private ownership of your labor. What you produce is yours. What you make is yours. What you put together is yours. It's yours. You get to decide how to distribute it, to give it away, to exchange it, to sell it, to put it in the closet. You get to decide. It's not a purse. It's not a common collective purse. It's not a collective like the Borg. The Borg is a collective. That's the difference between the two. One believes in individual inalienable rights to what you produce and what you want to do with it. And the other one believes that somebody should have the authority to take anything you produce away from you and use it for whatever they think is best. Whether by democratic vote or by a despot or by a totalitarian, you don't get to decide. The community as a whole, what is that, democracy? Democracies always lead to despotism. That's what they've said throughout history, 300 years before Christ, at the time of Christ. Plutarch said it, Polybius said it, people in Athens said it, Socrates said it, Benjamin Franklin said it, everybody has said it. So I don't know why anybody thinks that democracy is a good thing. It used to say, the government used to tell you that democracy was a bad thing. They used to teach that. Not even 100 years ago they were teaching that. Now, the American government officially says democracy is a good thing. And everybody's mind has been changed. It's been altered. You think a different way now. And it took a while to get you to think this way as a society, but they got you to think this way. And you don't realize, why did people used to say it was bad, and now they say it was good? I mean, some of the freest nations in the world thought it was bad. America used to think it was bad. Now they think it's good. Somebody changed the way you see things. Wow, that's amazing. So capitalism is not a political theory. It's not a political system. It's an economic system that says you get to own what you produce and decide what to do with it. Your labor belongs to you. Now, one of the things that these guys kept going over and talking about was a guaranteed basic income so that you could have free time to do what you think you want to do. Well, the only way you can have that guaranteed basic income is that you guarantee to take away what somebody else produces so that they can't do with what they want by their own choice. Somebody else will choose. And I'm always amazed that people don't trust people to be charitable, to care about their neighbor, to help one another out. They don't trust them to do that, but they trust the government to do it for them. They even suggest that it'd be more efficient, but that's just something they've been told because history does not prove them out. The present time, do you think, you know, the government can do things more efficiently than the private sector? No, there's no evidence to that fact. As a matter of fact, it's very clear the private sector is often way more efficient. It requires certain checks and balances, but the private sector is often doing things way better. You know, and people say, you know, I heard somebody interviewing a famous politician was saying, so under your, there would be no air traffic controllers because that's government funded. There wouldn't be any schools because that's government funded. No, there were schools before everybody went to public school, and we had a higher degree of literacy in this country than we have today. Air traffic controllers, France, that's a private. Air traffic controllers is a private deal. It's paid for by runway license fees. And other, you know, taxes for on hauling goods through the air. But it's privately done. It's not done by the government. And it works. They're very efficient at it. So the idea that it's not done by government, it is a ridiculous, foolish assumption to think that it can't be done. Because it was done for years and years and years and very effectively. Somebody told you that, oh, let's have the government do it. And somebody said that will be easier. And was it easier? Well, now you have a vast bureaucracy that is sucking the life out of the citizenry. And it's not really very efficient. Government waste? I mean, there's whole newspapers that were dedicated to publishing information about government waste. The waste is so gargantuan now in society, we can't even measure it all. It's just staggering. So anyway, socialism gives those powers of choice that used to be in the hands of the individual to the collective, and the collective is determined by a number of different means. These two systems of capitalism and socialism are opposed to each other by the very definition, because one believes in private ownership and the other one, there is no private ownership. It's a collective, like I said, the Borg. So anyway, at one point in the video, it was suggested that the passing of Social Security Act back in the 1933 created a more robust society, keeping people out of cardboard boxes. That's what they actually imagine took place. Well, actually, that actually isn't. There's lots of people still living in cardboard boxes. And there's a lot more people per capita that are in need of aid today than there were back then. I gave some statistics. Here they are. All levels of government welfare before the Social Security Act was passed amounted to no more than $200 million. So that means that, boy, with only $200 million going to welfare, there must have been lots of people in cardboard boxes. Nobody was helping those people out. They were just must have been starving left and right and dying all over the place. It must have been just horrible, you know. I mean, you're tripping over bodies in the street because it was only $200 million in the entire United States going to helping out welfare. Right? No, not right. Just private philanthropy. You know, charitable institutions were giving over $1 billion back then. You know, five times as much was being given out just in the philanthropic organizations, not the other way, you know, families helping families, neighbors helping neighbors, and a lot of non-organizational charity that which went on all the time. I can give you just hundreds of stories of some widow lady who lived in a little house and it wasn't being heated, and somebody, neighbors just made sure there was firewood. We do that here still. We've been cutting firewood for, we didn't have to cut firewood for this fall, a local widow lady, because her woodshed is full of firewood, because people, every time they cut any, we had a lot of trees go down last year, and they just filled their entire woodshed full of wood. That wouldn't be counted in that $1 billion back then, that kind of stuff, and that was the majority of it. And it brought people together. People appreciated that. You know, when we were taking care of the elderly in this community, we had some people bedridden, and they brought them home, thought they'd be dead in a couple of weeks, but they lived for months and months and months and months. And, you know, just today, you know, my wife's out doing things for another widow lady down the street, you know, loading tires for her, takes in her groceries, all that. I mean, there's nobody down at the welfare office that's going to do that. There's nobody at Social Security that's going to come down and do that. You can't even get the local preacher to do that kind of stuff. Oh, no, no, that would actually be ministering to somebody, helping somebody. We don't do that. You know, that's somebody else's job. You see how robotic you become? Even the ministers have become brutes. But that's really what binds the society together. I just had somebody who lived in the city for years and years, and he's moved. He hasn't actually moved completely out of here, but he's put up a house, and he was just telling me this morning he did it because this community, it is so great. Everybody comes and helps everybody else. They can't believe that. And really, you know, this community sucks compared to the average Christian community back in the days of Christ. But compared to what you see in the cities, I mean, we got them beat hands down. We're way better off out here than they are, because there's still a remnant of that understanding of the bonds of society. And so the idea that Social Security somehow ended in people living in cardboard boxes is absolutely ridiculous. It certainly didn't end the poor. It's not strengthening the poor today. People have become more and more reliant upon the benefactors who exercise authority that provide the funds. And the bonds, the invisible bonds that used to connect us between each other as a community, as a society, are gone. You know, so before Social Security and the Great Depression, there was somebody caring for the poor. And it was not only private charities, but churches, neighborhoods, peoples, neighbors, family. You know, how many times, that was another discussion we had with somebody that I was helping out for free next door, and was talking to him about family bonds. And there are so many, he was talking about somebody particular that had been in the community, and when they passed away, their family, he had been completely estranged from all of his kids. They didn't want to talk to him. Well, I shouldn't say all, because some of them actually did show up. But they wouldn't talk to him. They didn't call him. They didn't know what was going on with him. And they didn't care. They were mad at him. They were angry with him. And they didn't have to mend those fences. And he didn't have to. He had his Social Security check. He didn't need his family. So he didn't mend his fences. I've seen it with people on welfare that, you know, they married some jerk and he abandoned them, and then they had to go on welfare. They could have gone back home. The family would have taken them in. The family would have helped watch the baby, and they could have gone out and worked. But no, they went on welfare. Almost killed them. Because they had way too much time on their hands, and they got into all kinds of trouble. Had they gone back home, the family would have taken care of them. And the bonds of the family could have grown. Forgiveness would have had to come to play in the situation. Everybody would have been stronger as a family because they took the time to help one another out. Don't have to do that anymore. You see, these great societies, these socialist societies, cause a breakdown of these bonds, these natural bonds that were in society. It weakens society, which is what was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah in a time of affluence. they did not strengthen the poor. Now, you know, just look at, so social virtue suffers immensely under these social schemes. It just doesn't exist. It's not important. You know, you'll see a little bit, and people suddenly, you know, somebody does something for a neighbor and everybody calls them a hero. It used to be a common everyday occurrence. It used to be the way that people operated in society. It wasn't even expected. It was just natural. But now we have government doing it for us. So anyway, I threw out a couple of statistics too on payroll tax, which is substantially increased from the original 1933 investment. But if you had invested just in 1 year United States Treasury bonds, Treasury securities, you would have a return far more than Social Security payments do. So it's not even a wise investment. If you had invested the same amount, you know, over the years that you pay into Social Security, into say 6 month CDs, just your average 6 month CDs, at market rates, the return would have been far greater than even U.S. Treasury bonds. All this would have given you more incentive to saving, and saving would have been good for the economy because you would have had more money in banks to be borrowed, and you wouldn't have had to have the Federal Reserve. You know, if you go back, right at the time of the 1933 passage of the Social Security Act, there was a depression that had been going on since 1929. Do you know why that existed? That existed because the Federal Reserve withdrew credit. It was giving all kinds of credit, loaning all kinds of money into circulation. People were taking that money at low rates of interest and buying stocks with it. And then eventually, when the credit was retracted, the money wasn't available to buy stocks. And so the stocks stopped going up and started going down. And a lot of people had to sell at a loss because they were buying those stocks with borrowed money. And they couldn't borrow money to pay off that debt. And why? Because the Federal Reserve withdrew credit. Why did it withdraw credit? Because there were less assets. Federal Reserve is socialism. That's actually what it is. It's socialism. Even Bernie Sanders says this, that the Federal Reserve is socialism for the rich. Now, the amazing thing, and I had some more statistic, payroll taxes, if you had invested your money in stocks over a 46-year period, just average, you know, low-risk stocks, you would have accumulated way more. Your Social Security payments out of those stocks would be almost three times what it is now. So, it was really a bad investment. But the idea of somehow socialism being the solution, socialism in Federal Reserve, in the breakdown of the family because of Social Security, you don't need your parents don't need you. It's the Corbin of the Pharisees that makes the Word of God to none effect that Christ was talking about. That's what Herod had set up, a system of Social Security where you had to pay in. And the government, through the synagogues and through the temple, which were government buildings, took care of the needy of society, including your parents. And we see that conversation going on in John, where the parents are worried they don't want to get kicked out or they'll lose their Social Security check. You know, whatever they used to get a token, that's how they did it. They didn't do it with a check. But they got this free bread and giveaway. They were going to lose that. And the funny thing is, in the course of the questions, and we'll end it here, these guys were asking the question, are there ways to encourage volunteerism? Stop Social Security. Of course, you can't do that overnight, but you can start weaning yourself off it. Stop these giveaway programs. Stop things like the Federal Reserve. You can't make them go away, but stop being dependent on them. Start seeking something else that you would be dependent on, which is a society within society, of people who care about each other and operate not by force, not by automatic contributions, but by faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty. This is what Christ was preaching. And these guys are actually teaching you to go the absolute opposite way. There's a lot more to this, and we'll have to deal with it at another time, because we're out of time. You can go see the videos on the website, and we'll see you next week, and we'll talk about this. I've got to go back out and tend to those sheep. Until then, may peace be upon your house, and may God be with you. God bless.